The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. And we're going to be talking about the internet today. We're going to be talking about computers and the future of our media system. This is going to be a recorded show, just to let you know it is a recorded show. We taped it shortly before going on air. So today, don't call in and ask questions. Just make yourself a cup of tea, sit back and relax, and let the pros do the talking. My guest today, Christian Sandvig, is an assistant professor of speech communication at the University of Illinois and a visiting fellow at the Internet Institute at Oxford University. He's an expert on the social, technical, and legal issues involved with the introduction of new technologies. Most recently, he's been investigating the implications of wireless internet technology for social equality. He's written widely in this topic and has been a featured speaker at numerous international conferences on the internet. Professor Sandvig is also deeply involved in research initiatives on internet policy, and he's a member of the activist group Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. Welcome to Media Matters, Christian.
Thank you, Bob.
Delighted to have you here. Now, you've been on campus 2 years now, is that right?
I've been a professor 2 years, but actually I spent the last year at Oxford.
Okay. Yeah, really? So you've been in Oxford the past year?
No, this academic year. I've been on campus. Okay. That's my second year, but I was in Oxford before that.
Now I get you. In 01, 02?
That's right.
Okay, now I've got you. And so you're in the Department of Speech Comm. You get your PhD at Stanford?
That's right.
Communications. Okay, so now everyone's got their background on you. Now, you're involved in the group Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. What is that group? Who are they? What do they do? What's your capacity?
Well, I'm just a member of the group, but the group itself has an interesting history. They started with the debate surrounding the first Star Wars. You remember Star Wars number one, right?
Yeah, back in the Reagan years.
Right. Well, this is a group of computer activists, mainly initially in the Silicon Valley, who were upset by claims that were being made in the media and by the government about what computers could and couldn't do. The idea was that they thought that Star Wars was simply unworkable as a technology and that the kinds of claims being made for computerization were irresponsible. So mm-hmm. they thought that there was a role for experts in computing to step forward and participate in public debate. Since then, though, they've moved on from Star Wars and they've talked about a number of issues. The national information infrastructure debates in the 90s, they were very active in that. They also have a variety of working groups on issues like women in computing, on labor in computing, things like internet governance, ICANN.
So they're trying to basically influence the policies that shape the internet and with their expertise.
That's right.
I see. And what's you're just a member of the group. How many members
That's
are
right.
there?
Gosh, I don't know off the top of my head.
Is there a chapter in Champaign-Urbana?
There's an Illinois chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You can find out more at the CPSR website, which is cpsr.org.
Yeah, in fact, I would check that website out just for when on air, and I agree. It was just really extraordinary, and I'd urge people to check it out if they are interested in the internet and they want to get involved, because I think one of the things about the internet, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, Christian. Well, don't correct me if you think I'm wrong, but just sort of quietly disagree with me. One of the things about the internet that's most striking to me is that it is such an extraordinary technology, digital communication, networked communication, that it's almost magical. It seems almost beyond someone's ability to understand that it's actually a discrete technology and that it follows certain protocols and that it's the consequence of explicit policies that put it in place to make it possible and can be shaped by policies. People oftentimes just think this magical thing that nothing can be tamed. It sort of rides roughshod over the universe. But in fact, there are a whole range of crucial technologies and policies that are closely related that can determine which direction it does develop and which direction it doesn't develop, and that 1,500 years from now, the nature of the world will look radically different in many respects depending which sort of technological choices and policy choices that are going to be made now and in the coming few years. Is that a safe assessment, do you think?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, the thing about the internet that fascinates me is that really it's a case where the mystification we feel now about the internet is the same mystification that we feel at the introduction of any new communication technology.
And you've studied this, haven't you?
Yes, that's right.
Give us some good examples, if you would, then.
Well, actually, I mean, you're more of an expert in historical comparative research than I am, I think. But consider, for example, the telephone. I mean, this was magical when it first came out. The radio, definitely. It was amazing.
The telegraph, consider
right,
that.
That's
mind-boggling technology.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I believe there was a debate in Congress over the introduction of a radio to the floor of, I believe it was the Senate. And if I remember correctly, I'm not entirely sure, I think that the senators were afraid that if they put a radio on the floor, anarchists would be able to transmit a bomb into the Senate chamber. So this is the same kind of mystification that we see now. But clearly, mm-hmm. the early decisions have a great impact over the years. The radio that we have now is based fundamentally on the decisions that were made 80, 90 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what sort of policy, and what are some of the crucial policies that have shaped to make the internet what it is now, and, where, and the sort of debates that are going on today that people should keep an eye on if they're interested in this?
Well, the big misconception about the internet is that it's this amazing unregulated force that really there was an FCC policy paper a while back called The Unregulation of the Internet, which is a fascinating title because it really couldn't be more wrong.
How old is that? Just curious.
I think it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of the internet as something that is unregulated and untamed really ignores the fact that the internet, the way that it's evolved in the way that it's evolved is built on top of the telecommunications infrastructure. So rules about telecommunications fundamentally affect the internet because it's a second order system. Mm-hmm. Initially, people said, well, because there aren't any laws that say internet in them, that means that there is no law on the internet. But we know that that's not true. Certainly the law doesn't have to say the name of a particular technology to apply to it. Then there are also a lot of laws about specific technologies like telephone, like things like electromagnetic spectrum that are very important for the internet. And yet people assume that the internet is still this unregulated free space.
We had Dan Schiller on Media Matters a while back talking about the telecommunication industry, which is, you know, such a central industry in our economy and in our society. Telecommunication is a fancy way of basically saying telephones, mm-hmm. although it's coming to encompass much more than that with the rise of digital technologies. But you're right. I mean, the telephone industry, the telecommunications, has always been a government heavily regulated, government created, giving away monopoly licenses to companies. And so to the extent the internet's built on top of that, it's being built on top of government-created industries. The government's central to how it's going to develop. And one of the crucial things that allowed for the development of the internet, the quick development of it, was that it regulated sort of the phone companies having to carry internet service providers. They couldn't charge them through the teeth, so it made it easy for people to offer that service and make the spread of it much more rapid than it would have been otherwise. Isn't that right?
That's right. That's the enhanced service provider exemption mm-hmm. in the FCC. The question at issue was whether people should consider new internet companies as telephone companies because they're providing communication services in ways that you might think of as similar to communication companies that run telephones. So maybe they should be charged the same access charges that telephones are charged. Now, all this sounds very arcane, but the important point to remember is just that there are specific decisions made at the FCC and in Congress and in state legislatures and in technology standards meetings that really have a lot to say about what the internet is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important not to think of, it's important to not think of it as something that's unregulated.
We're talking to Christian Sandvig today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about the internet, the crucial policies that are determining and will continue to determine exactly how it evolves and develops, what role it will play in our lives. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in today. Just sit back, relax, put your feet up, enjoy the show as much as you can. And, you know, as you probably know, Christian, there's been a lot of talk about, in terms of regulating the internet, looking at it in sort of discrete levels, the infrastructure level, the telecoms and cable pipes or the bandwidth used to sort of send the messages that are the basis of the network. And then also the level of the protocol and software that systems run on. And then the level of content that gets carried over the web. A lot of your work has dealt with that first level that I want to talk about because I think it's really one of the most extraordinary stories in the internet today, if not the most extraordinary technological development, and one that's all about policy fights to enable it. And that is the issue of Wi-Fi. And why don't you tell, what is Wi-Fi? I mean, everyone's going to be, alert listeners who aren't familiar with this term now, you will be soon. Trust me, this is a term that's growing in prominence, and it's going to be a big issue in our society. It's becoming one very rapidly. So, Christian, what is Wi-Fi?
Well, let's explain that with an example. So let's imagine that you got broadband access to the internet or high-speed access to the internet. So you went out and you subscribed to a cable modem service from the cable company or...
That's what I've got.
A cable modem, yeah. Or a DSL service from your telephone company.
And those are basically... Traditionally, those are the two choices people think of. You're either going to go through the cable wire or the phone wire to get broadband access to the internet.
Right. So let's say, just like you, Bob, that somebody went and they got cable modem. So the cable modem provides high-speed internet, but the wire probably goes to your living room because that's where your television is. So you've got cable modem and you think to yourself, well, I really want high-speed internet, but I want it upstairs. I want it in my den. I don't want it in my living room. So the cable company, depending on where you are, will offer you, oh, we can run a cable for you from your living room to your den or your home office or wherever you want. But it's going to be expensive. So you think to yourself, well, how difficult is it? Maybe you ran your own phone wire once for an extension. It can't be really that difficult. So you decide that you're going to run a wire. You run the same kind of wire that you would if you were at an office or at a university, an Ethernet cable. So this is the thing that looks like a phone jack, but not quite, that you get high-speed internet from if you've got Ethernet at your office. So you decide to run that, but instead of drilling all those holes and messing around inside your walls, an alternative is something called wireless Ethernet. So wireless Ethernet, you buy something. The first commercial product was called the Apple AirPort. It looked a little like a translucent UFO. It was white.
How many years ago did this come out?
That was in 1999.
Okay, so that's ancient history by the standards
that's right,
of this technology.
That's right.
That's like the War of the Roses or something.
Right, so... You'd buy an Apple AirPort and you'd put it next to your high-speed connection, which is in your living room. And then instead of drilling holes in your wall and running a wire, you would just get a little teeny card that talks to that AirPort via radio. And then you put that card upstairs or in any room that you want. If you put it in your laptop, you could go out and use the internet on your porch or while reclining on your deck, anywhere you'd like. Because the wireless signal just replaces the Ethernet. So a lot of people thought of wireless Ethernet as a way of solving small networking problems in the home. So Wi-Fi is the industry name for this. It's supposed to evoke hi-fi, the, you know, the stereo enthusiast's quest for ever greater sound quality. So Wi-Fi is wireless fidelity as opposed to high fidelity.
So it's basically that with the expensive last stretch of access to the internet comes through a wireless connection. So the signal comes through a wire into your home. Then from the living room, wherever the node is or the center, it goes wireless to anywhere in the house you are, as long as you've got a card in your computer.
Absolutely. And it's not very large range at all. It's really something like 150 feet of range for that UFO-looking access point. But the interesting thing about Wi-Fi, going back to the AirPort, when Steve Jobs introduced the AirPort at an Apple conference.
Steve Jobs, the founder and CEO of Apple.
That's right. Yeah. He said it's a liberating experience to use the internet while moving freely around your home or office. So this is really what he had envisioned, is this little last 150-foot stretch. You wouldn't be cabled. However, you know, the signal isn't stopped by walls. It goes all over the place within that 150-foot radius, sometimes farther. And so if you're walking down the street and you have a Wi-Fi-capable device, maybe it's something like a Palm Pilot, maybe it's something like a laptop where you have one of these cards, and you open up your laptop, you might find that you can check your email, but you don't know how. You're getting a signal, but the signal is from someone else's purchase in some house along that street or some office
street. So you can use – this is interesting. If you've got a card in your computer so you can get Wi-Fi, you can use anyone's Wi-Fi signal if you're in their range. Are you going to muscle them out though? If I walk by your house with my computer and I have my Wi-Fi card in it and I say, hey, I can get this signal now. I don't have to pay for it. This is great. Does it mean if you're in there working on your computer, suddenly you're muscled out because I'm taking over your bandwidth? Or how does that work?
Typically not. Well, we should back up and say that the reason that you can use anyone's Wi-Fi access instead of just one that you bought is because the people who came up with Wi-Fi were really concerned that this technology be easy to use. They felt that earlier wireless technologies had failed because they'd been so difficult to set up and configure. And so they set up Wi-Fi in a way to be very promiscuous. So the default settings that you get out of the box if you just install one of these access ports means that anyone can use your bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
You can change those settings if you want to, but the way the technology was designed, it's harder to have a secure network than it is to have this default of an open network where anyone can use your bandwidth. As to whether you'll crowd someone out if you happen to be standing in front of their house using your laptop, chances are you won't, because the amount of bandwidth provided by Wi-Fi is very high, and most people don't use nearly all of the capacity that you would see in a Wi-Fi access point. So it's, in fact, very unlikely that you would cause them any measurable harm. That hasn't stopped people from saying that these free riders are thieves, that they're criminals, and that the important next step for Wi-Fi is to hunt them down and prosecute them.
Oh, man. That's just what we need. Yeah, we aren't arresting enough people in this culture. Let's get a few more behind bars. we're talking to Christian Sandvig today, professor of speech communication at the University of Illinois. We're talking about Wi-Fi, the revolutionary new development in Internet, and one that may well change much about Internet culture. Some people argue that Wi-Fi and mobile Internet access in general will be to this decade what the web was to the 90s and what the personal computer was to the 80s, that it's that significant of a revolution. Is that your sense?
Well, we've seen a lot of talk about this idea of a ubiquitous network, that the mm-hmm. Internet is going to be everywhere at some unforeseen point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have different visions about how that's going to happen. Wi-Fi, in a way, is one vision of how the Internet might become ubiquitous. It might become everywhere. I'm pretty convinced that it's going to be everywhere. I'm just not sure that Wi-Fi is the way.
Yeah.
Another way might be through the cellular phone network,
mm-hmm.
for
mm-hmm.
example.
Now, the way Wi-Fi works, though, I mean, where it gets interesting is if it's just like, you know, you have the wire going to your house or into an office, and then you have a wireless inside the office or the house. Now, that's great. It saves you a lot of money, and it's sort of cool, and it gives you freedom there. But where it gets interesting, it seems like, is with the example you gave later, where you can walk by someone else's house and start using it off their Wi-Fi connection. Because then if you've got a whole city Wi-Fi'd up, so that like a cell phone network, so that everywhere in a community has a Wi-Fi, it's conceivable then that no one has to get cable modems anymore. No one has to pay the phone company for DSL. Everyone, you could have a sort of a cooperative use of a Wi-Fi network. And lots of people would save money. We wouldn't have to tear up all these houses, and it'd be much less expensive and universally accessible. Is that true, what I'm saying? Is that possible?
It's possible. I mean, you'd still need somewhere for the Internet connectivity to come from. So probably you definitely need broadband at some point.
You would need a fiber optic network to connect your main trunk lines to where you would do the radio signals.
Another way of thinking about this is that Alessandro Ovi came up with this phrase for Wi-Fi networks. He called them water lilies. He
mm-hmm.
said that if you think of a pond and you think of a city as a pond, water lilies cover a pond, but it's not in a centrally planned manner. Instead, they each sort of grow on their own, but after a while, the pond is completely covered by water lilies. Wi-Fi is the same sort of thing. You can cover a city with wireless connectivity, but it's not a centrally planned thing. Each node is bought for a particular purpose by someone who just doesn't want to rewire their house. But in the end, as you say, maybe you get something that looks like complete coverage.
Mm-hmm.
In his metaphor of water lilies, the stem of the water lily is really a pipe to the Internet,
mm-hmm.
because that's what makes the Wi-Fi valuable. There are some far-out proposals where you wouldn't really need a stem to the Internet, like a cable modem or a fiber optic line or DSL, but I think that's a little far out for now.
The entire thing could be wireless, basically?
That's right,
I mean,
yeah.
So everything's done through the air.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is, you know, the buzzword that's often used when you talk about access to the Internet is bandwidth and how fast it is. I mean, once you go on a cable modem or you're on a campus Ethernet connection, it's very hard to go back to the dial-up phone because you get impatient. You're used to really quick action. How quick is a Wi-Fi network? I mean, you sense if it's coming through the airways, it's going to be pokey. It's going to be a lot slower than those big fat wires, a cable wire. How does Wi-Fi compare to a cable wire or DSL line?
Well, the most common flavor of Wi-Fi right now is about, the maximum speed is 11 megabits per second, but functionally, as far as user experience, you would feel the same as if you were using an Ethernet cable in your office. And that's one reason people call it wireless Ethernet. So, in mm-hmm. fact, it's not pokey at all. And the newer versions of Wi-Fi are five times faster than that.
And conceivably, the technology could increase the speed or the bandwidth radically. I mean, it's nothing, there's no distinct limits built into it. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, that's really amazing. It could conceivably be a lot cheaper than cable or telephone. It conceivably could be every bit as fast, if not faster. It lets people have mobility. Are there lots of capitalists and corporations rushing to provide this service? Boy, it sounds like it's this, you know, if there's ever, you know, I'm not a genius at marketing, but boy, you don't have to add 2 + 2 to figure out this one sounds like a winner.
Yeah, this is a great story, actually. It brings us back to 1995, a little earlier than the Apple Airport. This was already seen as a great investment opportunity for people who wanted to provide internet access. There's a company you might have heard of called Metricom. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I think I probably lost my life savings on them.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, Metricom, bankrupt now, Metricom was in the business of reading utility meters with radio. So the meter reader could drive around the neighborhood and he wouldn't have to actually go into your yard. He would use a radio provided by Metricom. About 1995, the board at Metricom or someone had the great idea that if they had this large national network to provide data service over radio, the internet is a data service, so maybe they could leverage that into providing internet over radio. So they created a service called Ricochet. Ricochet was absolutely top drawer, first-rate service. A lot of technical innovation, very high speed for its time. You could get a Ricochet modem for something like $75 or depending on what year you bought it. This service, they rolled it out by covering the 21 largest metropolitan areas in the United States with transceivers. I mean, think about what a project that was.
Transceivers.
Well, radio stations, you might say, so that when you've got one of these devices from Metricom.
They transmit signals.
That's right.
Okay.
So 21 of the largest metropolitan areas, it cost them $1.1 billion to do this. Because of the frequency characteristics of the technology, they had to put one of these radio stations on something like 1 in every 8 streetlights in order to make it work. And you can still see them. Go up to Chicago, have a look at the streetlights. You can see the Metricom Ricochet transceivers still up there.
Mm-hmm.
So they invested all of this money. They offered a service that was technically excellent. Everyone raved about it. A number of patents, reasonably priced, maybe a little too high, but still you might say it's reasonably priced. And they went bankrupt. They went bankrupt in
And it would have been a wireless internet access?
It's not exactly the same as Wi-Fi, but yes, it's wireless basically. Internet access. Yes, that's right. Slower, but
seamless
it was
So you could have gone anywhere around Chicago and you would have picked it anywhere.
In fact, in some ways, it's better than Wi-Fi because Metricom's network, you could drive around with a laptop and the network would give you a continuous connection even though you were moving, which is something you can't do right now with Wi-Fi.
So
it was great. So what happened?
Yeah,
this
what
was
happened?
A fantastic idea, and then it didn't go anywhere. Well, Metricom Ricochet had this idea that the key people who want to use their technology are this sort of mythical businessman who travels to a number of cities all the time. So their marketing plan was that if you're going to provide wireless internet...
The one who's in all the IBM ads.
That's right. That's him.
Yeah,
that's right.
Him.
Definitely a he, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he travels all the time, so he needs this internet connection in all 21 of the cities at once. You can't just start with one city and grow because he's very mobile.
Yeah.
And he's willing to pay a lot. I mean, so you can really price this service. You can price it pretty high. So the monthly fees for the service, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think they were maybe around $75 a month at the outset. So I'm not sure that he exists in the numbers that they were hoping for.
Yeah.
Instead, if you think about who's interested in using the internet via wireless, everyone is. You and I are, just because, as with the example we gave at the beginning of the show, you know, that person installing Wi-Fi in their home is just an average person who doesn't want to run a cable between their den and their living room.
And it costs a lot of money to run that cable.
That's right. That's right. So so they had it wrong. I mean, they weren't helped by the crash of the capital markets, right? So this was – they couldn't sustain their – business because they couldn't get any more funding.
Well, couldn't someone pick it up now and take over their network?
They have been. That's what's been happening. It's been sort of sectioned off and bits of it are now operational again as other services. But the interesting thing, I think, is the mindset. So that infrastructures we think of as things that are provided by governments and large corporations in our society. I mean, think about cable modems. If you are listening to this broadcast and you can't get a cable modem right now, or you can't get DSL because you're in an area outside the coverage, the motto of society right now is really just wait. Wait, and the companies will provide it for you. Mm-hmm. This is very much the model of Metricom Ricochet. If we're going to do this, it has to be a big corporation with a lot of money. It's going to be very expensive. We're going to roll out across the whole country all at once. Whereas if you look at the history of communication technology, a lot of the people who first started using new communication technologies were everyday people who really wanted the technology. They weren't giant corporations rolling out everywhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, the best example that I'm sure you know very well would be right here in Illinois, the early telephone co-ops. Who were the people who drove the revolution in telephony, especially in rural areas? These were farmers who wanted a phone. They weren't techno gurus and they weren't international businessmen.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So Wi-Fi is an interesting case because you see a giant centralized approach, Metricom Ricochet, collapse. It really failed. And then no one's that interested in trying it for a while, especially, as I said, given the state of the capital markets. But then at the same time, you see a technology that was meant for everyday people in their home to solve small networking problems.
Mm-hmm.
It suddenly acts like water lilies to provide equivalent coverage to Metricom Ricochet in large metropolitan areas. I mean,
we're talking to Christian Sandvik today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show, so don't call in today. Just sit back, put your feet up, make yourself a cup of tea, enjoy the show. For those of you listeners of Media Matters who would like to get a weekly email update on shows that we're doing, we offer that service. We have several hundred listeners who've taken advantage of it so far. And we will send you a weekly update on who our guests will be, who our last guest was, or forthcoming guests, with links to their articles and biographies of them, websites, and the works. You can stay on top of the program. Plus, it's a mechanism for you to give us ideas for stories, for shows, topics, and guests for shows. And to do that, all you have to do is go to my personal website, which is robertmcchesney.com. And on the homepage right there, there's a place you can click, and we'll sign you up. And we won't send you any advertising, no commercialism. We won't sell this list to anyone for any price. It's unbuyable. And if you want to get off the list, a simple email will get you yanked off it right away. We won't abuse the privilege you're giving us by putting us on that list. Today, our guest again, Christian Sandvik. And, you know, is this just a business story then about Wi-Fi and about wireless internet access, high-speed internet access? Or is there a policy story here, too? Is there something about, I mean, can it be shaped by what government does? Or is this just a matter of some rich entrepreneur, like, selling this?
Well, it's very much a policy story. So if we think of the idea of the early telephone again. So to give you an example, in 1910, if you lived in Liberty, Tennessee, you could get a telephone from a co-op called the Liberty Home Telephone Company, and you had to give them three things. One, you had to give them $25. Two, you had to promise to donate your labor to help build it. And three, you had to give them a pole. So you had to provide your own pole for the telephone. So this early way of building telephone networks, at the time, there was a policy mission for telephone. We wanted the telephone to spread across the country.
Mm-hmm.
One way that the telephone could spread is to be sure that these amateur and these activist sort of cooperatives and independent telephone systems would eventually all link up to provide
a national system. Technology so that your calls could go seamlessly from one of these networks to another one.
That's right. And you saw a big policy goal of the time was education. So, for example, in Britain, you still have these rules that if you're a farmer and you want to build your own phone network, the BT, British Telecom, has to teach you how to be sure that whatever network you built will be able to interconnect with them. There are also rules that say that they have to interconnect with you. So the policy mission is to build a giant network out of lots of individual networks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the goal. Today, we don't see that at all. Policy.
So try to encourage it at the grassroots level and then link it up.
That's right.
And so, that means it's not necessarily going to be the largest businesses doing it or necessarily business at all. It could just be citizens groups or nonprofit groups.
Right, absolutely. So the policy goal there is education and interconnection. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, with something like broadband, you don't see policy going that direction at all. You see policies very concerned with how to convince large corporations to make specific investments to roll out their network in areas that don't have network coverage now. Mm-hmm. This is very different than other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. If you go to Scandinavian countries, broadband internet, high-speed internet service will often be provided by a cooperative. Cooperatives are important in a lot of other areas too, but whether cooperatives are supportable partially has to do with policy support, whether interconnection and education are important goals.
Now, the thing about Wi-Fi, the spectrum isn't a limitless resource. I mean, it's not like, you know, there's only a certain amount of space there. And, you know, we know in the case of radio and television, for example, there's only a certain number of slots set aside for AM and FM radio channels in a community. Same thing for television. And if you don't have one of those slots, you can't use the spectrum to send a signal through the air. We know in cell phones, there's only a certain number of slots they can have cell phone calls on, and that limits the number of companies that can work. You just can't start a cell phone company unless you have access to the spectrum. You've got to get a license from the government. You've got to purchase it through an auction if you even want to have a cell phone company. And the satellite companies use spectrum to send their signals from satellites to Earth, the television companies. Where does spectrum fit into Wi-Fi? I mean, can anyone just start a Wi-Fi company, or do you have to somehow – where do you get your spectrum to use?
So the neat thing about Wi-Fi, or at least an unusual thing, is that the spectrum comes from unlicensed spectrum. So there's some of the electromagnetic spectrum set aside that you don't need any kind of license for at all. So if I want to provide a Wi-Fi access point in my home, I don't have to get a license to operate a radio station.
Channel 386,200. Right. You just can use it.
I just use it. And the way that that works is by all of the devices that use that spectrum agreeing that they won't transmit signals that are very strong so that they don't interfere with each other, and that if they do interfere with each other, there's really no redress. If, you know, you put too much communication technology on the spectrum and it becomes overloaded and it doesn't work, there's no one you can complain to. Whereas if you are a television station and someone is interfering with you, you certainly can see to it that the FCC shuts them down. So these are actually called unlicensed parks, and they're a really old idea. They started in the U.S. in 1984, and it's the same spectrum that gives you something like a cordless phone in your house, mm-hmm. a baby monitor, a garage door opener. Mm-hmm. These are all the same spectrum from the spectrum park.
Now, is this what's called spread technology?
Uh-huh.
Now, because this is, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because this isn't my area of expertise, but that never stops me from talking, as my listeners well know. In the case of radio and television and cell phones, the spectrum that's used is a discrete line. There's a discrete frequency or channel that the message goes on, and nothing else can be on it at that exact time in that proximity, or you'll jam. That's why you can't have two radio stations broadcasting over the AM 580 signal. All the listener would get would be interference. What makes this technology revolutionary is that it takes the spectrum, instead of allocating it into 1,000 channels, and so you have 1,000 users who each get a discrete channel, it's more the internet packet switching principle of communication, where the message is sent into this band that can jigger all over, finding an open slot in the spectrum and scooting through to the end. It doesn't have to stay on the same frequency. Truly a remarkable technology. But as I understand the spread technology, it means that you can get a lot more, use the spectrum much more efficiently. I mean, a vast increase, exponential increase in the amount of data that can be communicated in the same amount of spectrum.
Absolutely. And that's one reason that the computer industry is so upset about spectrum policy as it stands right now, because they feel that technologies like television are using vast amounts of the
spectrum in
comparison to the national importance, whereas something like Wi-Fi is using a very, very small spectrum allocation.
I mean, for most of our listeners, except for those who work at Beckman, what I'm about to ask you is going to seem absurd, but it's worth noting how much spectrum is allocated for Wi-Fi for spread uses now.
Well, there are two blocks right now, one in the 2.4 gigahertz range and one in the 5 gigahertz range. But
I got a feeling that's a lot of gigahertz.
Yeah, well, the key thing is actually it's not very good spectrum.
Yeah.
For example, in the 5 gigahertz range, it has a hard time going through interior walls.
Mm.
So this is a problem if you want to use it in your home, say.
It's sort of like soil. This is like trying to plant a seed out like in dry soil or
that's
near a parking lot. in the juicy, fertile, 10-foot-deep black soil spectrum. That's going to television.
That's right. You've got it. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's sort of not a rational use of spectrum necessarily. We're sort of giving these monopoly rights to huge swaths of spectrum to TV channels. And then we're putting this other service, which uses it much more efficiently, on the low-end spectrum.
Yeah, and this is a problem for technologies like Wi-Fi. So, so far I've painted a pretty rosy picture in our discussion, but if you go to a place like Palo Alto or Manhattan that has a lot of people who have already deployed this technology, you'll find that sometimes your Wi-Fi won't work because of congestion. There are already too many people using Wi-Fi close to you, so therefore this great new technology won't work. And the solution to that is just more spectrum, in that there currently is very little spectrum allocated to this.
Now, already I can see two very interesting things. One, I can see who's going to oppose the spread of Wi-Fi, the current existing owners of spectrum, who have it and have great value, are not going to be excited about giving it up, their licenses. And also the existing companies. I mean, I could imagine if I'm the head of AOL, Time Warner, Comcast, and I'm envisioning my future as putting these wires into people's houses, charging them $40, $50, $60 a month for cable modem access, or a phone company doing the same thing with DSL. Then along comes the technology which can offer superior bandwidth that requires no wire. I'm like the horse and buggy maker of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do they fight this, or do they fight it? I mean,
well, the interesting thing here is that really, as you said, a number of existing ISPs are at war with Wi-Fi right now. Mm-hmm. And the reason, I think, is partly spectrum, but it's also something called the oversubscription ratio. Mm-hmm. All this means is that if you're an internet service provider, you don't actually buy enough capacity to serve all of your customers at once, because you're counting on the fact that some of them are going to be asleep. Some of them are going to be doing things that don't take very much capacity.
So email or something.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So you do what's called oversubscription. Mm-hmm. You promise people more bandwidth than you have. The telephone company does it too. Everyone in the communication industry does something
like
this.
It's like a bank lending out more money than they actually have, because they don't figure people are going to call in their accounts on the same day.
That's right. But what if all of your customers buy Apple AirPorts or Wi-Fi access points, and they start sharing their technology with anyone who walks by, so you get multiple users on the same line. Mm-hmm. So this is terrible for the oversubscription ratio. So the ISPs are worried they're going to lose customers, and they're suddenly going to have to pay a lot more to provide what they've promised. So the way that they've gone to war is by rewriting their subscriber agreements, prohibiting what's called connection sharing. Not all of them are doing this, but some of them are. And they've done things like they've made statements in public policy fora, such as in the extreme case, sharing is illegal, free riding on Wi-Fi is theft and should be criminalized, it's the same as hacking, it's the same as stealing.
You know, as I look at this technology, the way you describe it, and I've read a bit about it in a few other places, you know, it strikes me that if someone were just to come to the United States today, you know, they were airdropped in from, you know, Lesotho or something, and they were educated in the technological possibilities of Wi-Fi or wireless broadband using this sort of spread use of the spectrum. And they look at the cost of doing cable or telephone wires into the home and the efficiency of using spectrum when you allocate licenses for distinct units as opposed to spread. The rational thing to me would be, look, you take a big chunk of the prime real estate, give it to spread, and you can have it a much lower cost. You know, super fast bandwidth to everyone in the country at a vastly lower cost at the size at the side of establishing the network and at the reception. It seems like a much more rational use of the spectrum and of the technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more.
What are the listeners? And let's hope we get a vote of 2-0 here. We'll take a poll of all our listeners. Let's say our listeners out there going, "Yeah, this makes a lot of sense. This is a rational use. This would be really good for our society." What can they do to make that be the situation, or something like that? What are the computer professionals for social responsibility? What are concerned citizens in the technology community doing to try to push this along, and who are they fighting with, and who are they fighting against?
Well, partly because of technology like Wi-Fi. The spectrum allocation is suddenly an open question in the United States in a way that it wasn't really just a few years ago. today, the government is really thinking hard about how to reform Spectrum, because there's been growing pressure from computing, as I said, but also from other groups, that the way we're doing it now just isn't working.
Now, where is this debate going on? Who's having it? Because, you know, I don't see this on, you know, when I on TV news or anything or in the newspaper.
That's right. It's mainly going on at the FCC. For example, there was just recently a task force on spectrum reform that met with a number of government agencies to try and figure out what we could do about reforming the way that spectrum is allocated. Right now, it just doesn't seem to be working. Some of the recommendations are, well, generally the recommendations are much more conservative than yours. So they tend to be things like we should try to expand unlicensed spectrum, like parks, for example, the spectrum that Wi-Fi uses. One way to do that that's slightly novel might be to do things like combine these unlicensed spread spectrum technologies with television, use them on the same spectrum, and just trust that one is low powered enough that it won't interfere with the other. Sometimes these are called underlays. So this is one example. The way to influence this debate is really to get involved with organizations like the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility.
Now, what if you're a computer amateur like me? What, is there a group for computer amateurs for social responsibility? I mean, there's do I have to get a job at, like, in the computer industry or something?
Well, I hope that everybody is welcome at the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. I mean, one of the things that CPSR does is try to educate the public about issues that are very arcane. So I shouldn't scare you off by saying the first two letters.
Yeah, because, I mean, I can barely figure out how to turn my computer on. I just know how to use it once I get it on.
Right. Well, I mean, it's an arcane debate. I mean, it's confusing, all kinds of strange jargon in a way. Their interests, making sure that it is this arcane. This isn't something that a lot of the existing, the television companies don't want on the television news, that television is using spectrum inefficiently.
Now, if I'm in the television industry and I'm one of the handful of companies that dominate television station ownership in this country and have the licenses to use the spectrum, and they're just licenses, they don't own the spectrum, as many of our listeners, I suspect, may not know since it's not a widely advertised fact, are these companies trying to look at ways they can convert, like you were saying, their spectrum, this prime real estate, these big chunks of juicy, fertile spectrum they've got that are being barely used to their capacity now or underused? Are they trying to find ways to convert that to a spread technology or a Wi-Fi system that then they could somehow control and collect the money for?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, I think the television, the broadcasting industry's response to spectrum reform has been defensive. We're going to keep what we have, and you can't stop us. And looking at the history of policy in this area, you can see why.
They always win.
Yeah. That's right. So,
is it because of the strength of their arguments or the strength of their lobby?
I would guess definitely the lobby. And they also have history on their side as well. A lot of televisions is difficult to make any changes. This is really what we're talking about really is, in a way, the same debate as with digital television, high-definition television.
What committees in Congress, let's say you wanted to get a hold of members of Congress, so who's working on this in Congress? What committees handle issues like spectrum?
Well, committees like the Science and Technology Committee in the Senate. The same committees really that have oversight over the FCC. So if you want to know, you can go to the Congress website, and each committee has a list of its oversight, who it's responsible for overseeing. And you often see you see on this list, if you see the FCC, then that's the one of the committees that's relevant for this particular debate.
Well, clearly, Christian Sandvig, my guest today on Media Matters, there's going to be more spectrums necessary. Even if they don't get radically overturned the whole system, it's crucial that there be more spectrum allocated for spread use, for common use, so that it not all be given away to private interest to use as they wish. And then it seems like there is this burgeoning group of cooperative, local, like with the phone system you talked about 800 years ago, of local groups cooperatively putting together Wi-Fi networks. There's one, if I'm not mistaken, developing right here in Urbana. Is that right?
That's right. There's a wireless cooperative here in Urbana called the Champaign-Urbana Wireless Project. There's also wireless activity on campus. The university provides Wi-Fi service through an experimental new network. You can find out about that on the CITES website.
CITES, how is it?
I think it's CITES. That's the university's
Our engineer is nodding yes. Okay, CITES.
Right.
Okay.
There's also efforts like the PrairieNet effort, PrairieNet being a local community network To link up nonprofit organizations and community organizations using wireless. So they have a project in East St. Louis right now that's trying to use Wi-Fi as a low-cost alternative to buying a lot of leased lines or high-speed landlines that would provide internet service.
So in East St. Louis, which is, you know, as many of our listeners must know, is one of the poorest cities in the United States, using Wi-Fi as a way to get, you know, without going through that enormous expense of wiring a city, you can inexpensively use Wi-Fi to get everyone up internet access, and curiously at a much stronger rate, or as equal rate to anything you could get through broadband, telephone, or cable wire. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the hope. I mean, I have to worry about the prospects of the cooperatives, though. I mean, this is something maybe you can tell as we've been talking that I think is very exciting. But at the same time, there are a lot of alliances against the cooperatives, a lot of people that are making arguments that this is really something that should be commercialized, and the people who are out there planting open nodes, as they're sometimes called, are really just a sort of new breed of hippie, peace, love, and Wi-Fi.
What's wrong with that? Come on.
Right. Well, some
with
say—
some sourpusses.
That's right. That's right. I mean, an example there might be that in London last summer— there was someone named Black Belt Jones. I don't know if you heard the story of Black Belt Jones.
Go ahead. Even if I've heard, I don't think our listeners have.
Right. So Black Belt Jones is a computer consultant in London, and he walked around with his laptop and he found he could get wireless access all over the place. But he thought there must be a way to share this with someone so I'm not the only one who has to go painstakingly map these access points. And so he went and he thought. And he's a graphic designer, apparently, and he had read about things called hobo signs. Maybe some of the listeners know that in the Midwestern United States, particularly in the Great Depression, hobos and tramps used a sign language to communicate with each other. So they would take chalk or coal and they would mark barns with symbols that meant things like, this person will trade food for chores, or a good place to sleep is here. So Black Belt Jones, that's his online name, said, we can come up with a system of signs for Wi-Fi that will indicate where you can get open access to Wi-Fi. So he came up with these symbols that show you where you can go to get open Wi-Fi access. And in response, there was an outcry in the media about these Wi-Fi hackers who were marauding around trying to steal service and break into networks. It was a huge scare and a very
it
large
made it sound
amount.
Like with soccer hooligans, drunkards charging around the streets with their computers.
I mean, it was really apocalyptic press coverage. I mean, this...
does the name Rupert Murdoch come to mind with these newspapers when you talk about this in London? That's an aside.
Well, speaking of Black Belt Jones and his efforts, I mean, you can see an analog to what he's doing in corporations like Boingo. So if you want to find out where to get Wi-Fi access, you can go to a corporation called Boingo, and they map and they affiliate Wi-Fi networks together so you can tell them where you are. Mm-hmm. They'll tell you where the Wi-Fi is. Black Belt Jones is doing the same thing, and some of his at least people with the same ideas he has have made these free map servers that do exactly the same thing as Boingo. So what you have are similar services provided by corporations and by activists and amateurs at the same time, where one is free and one you have to pay for. So it's clear that a battle is brewing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it sounds like, on one hand, the way you've described it, it's sort of like the cooperatives versus the corporations. It's non-commercial versus commercial. But Larry Lessig, the noted Stanford University law professor, was a large proponent of spread technology. You know, he's also an advocate of capitalism. He argues that ultimately having this sort of cooperative spread access to the internet is actually very good for business because it'll lower their costs dramatically. It's not that business per se loses. It's really just these specific businesses that are trying to protect their dinosaur technologies and investments and force that to be the dominant technology.
That's absolutely right. And the research on how communication technology evolves says that in many cases, these amateur movements are a stage. For example, in the telephone industry, you probably don't get your telephone service right now from a farm co-op. But farm co-ops were very valuable at the beginning of the telephone industry to spur the development of the technology. So in a way, it's premature and it's a failure of It's a failure to learn from history to try and suppress cooperative and amateur activity now. It might be this is a kind of transition that we need in order to spread this technology to places where it doesn't currently exist.
So again, I just want to give our listeners a sense of what they can do if they really want to protect and promote Wi-Fi. I mean, at a personal level, here in Champaign-Urbana, they can get a hold of one of these networks and hook up with it and get involved with it. Is that right?
That's right. They can provide, if they, for example, if they have something like an Apple Airport, they can affiliate with a cooperative, perhaps the Champaign-Urbana one, or they can list themselves on lists of open networks on the internet so that they're saying, you can use my bandwidth. And they won't notice any difference mm-hmm. if they do this. I mean, it's very unlikely that anything mm-hmm. will be taken away from them. So this is saying it can't be theft because I'm agreeing to provide it for free.
So if I've got a computer in my house, I could join the network and give up some of my...
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm expecting a phone call from someone after the show. Then to get me on their network, which is fine. I'd look forward to it. Do you know who I would call locally if I wanted to do that, or someone in Champaign-Urbana if they wanted to get involved in one of these networks? So offhand, do you have a number? Or?
A way to start would be to look at websites like WiFiMaps.com.
And that covers you can just
that's think, the United States.
Yeah.
And you can list yourself as a node in that database. You can mm-hmm. also do things like search for the Champaign-Urbana project. If you're interested in the East St. Louis project, I'm sure that the people at PrairieNet would love to talk
mm-hmm.
to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also something you can just experiment with on your own and just to get a sense of it. For example, you can find Wi-Fi access at places like there are coffee shops in town, the Green Street coffee shop has Wi-Fi access.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that's really quite prevalent.
And I'm holding here, Christian Sandvig, in my hand, a press release from the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. And the headline is Expand Unlicensed Spectrum, what we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
but retain public interest review and dedicated uses. What does that mean?
Well, it's basically that people who care a lot about the public interest, when they think about spectrum policy, the idea of something like unlicensed spectrum seems kind of frightening. It sounds a little bit like auctions.
Letting commercial interests come in and just take it over.
That's right. It sounds like we're giving away something that we shouldn't be giving away.
Yeah.
But as I said, unlicensed spectrum parks aren't the same thing as an auction. It's not selling the spectrum to do whatever anyone wants if
mm-hmm.
they can pay the most money. Instead, it's saying this is a low-powered semi-experimental place where anyone can deploy without permission. The difference between this and an auction is that an auction is only going to produce uses that can be capitalized. You know, you have to raise a lot of money to participate in one of these auctions. But on the other hand, the open spectrum, the unlicensed spectrum, you don't need a lot of money to participate.
Could you send a radio and TV signals over unlicensed spectrum using spread technology? Is that eventually possible? Could you actually have a TV? So that is actually possible.
Sure.
They wouldn't need discrete signals.
Well, one of the things that some community activists have been excited about in the area of Wi-Fi is that the FCC's recent turnaround on low-power FM broadcasting has really let a lot of people down who were looking forward to trying to start a local low-power FM station.
Mm-hmm.
So they're thinking if they can use Wi-Fi to get broadband internet to their community, then they can just run the same station they were planning to run on the internet.
You know, Christian Sandvig, Assistant Professor of Speech Communication, I could talk to you about this for hours and hours. It's endlessly fascinating and I think endlessly important. I want to thank you very much for joining us today in Media Matters. It's been a real pleasure having you here, and let's get you back again.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
All right, goodbye.